to me. Oh!
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, on location. We have a lot to share today. Of course, always beginning with the latest on health and healing and living a longer life. Then we're going to play some different types of audio clips that are leading into my guest. My guest is a very deep thinker. We're going to have one of those conversations with Remarkable Minds a little later on. But what about the non-remarkable minds? Many, not all, of the millennials. In fact, from a millennial and from an articulate and a person trying to change it around, you're going to hear him say, quote, the most dumbed down and brainwashed generation in history. True, not true, you decide. Also, a millennial goes on a rant. We'll play that. It's only 2 minutes. And then one of our listeners sent me a little clip. Now, I've never watched Dr. Phil. I have no interest in Dr. Phil. But evidently, he was interviewing a teenager who is a millennial and who believes that they're entitled to a particular allowance. And it's not about them working. They don't want to work. But it's the argument that this person has with her mother. Now, why would I play this? Because unless you pull back far enough of a problem, you're not going to see it in its right context. Think of the numbers I've given you. For example, everyone in the media, mainstream and alternative, using the 3.9% unemployment level. We shared with you the actual number of unemployed, the actual number of people working 2 to 3 jobs and still can't afford any quality of life. And those who are no longer seeking work and therefore excluded from the unemployment numbers, if you put the real numbers together of those who would like to work, have work, but can't find regular work, we're 27 to 28% unemployment. That would give us a completely different perspective of ourselves. Now, think of the number of people who are rich. Now, right now, China just passed the United States with a couple more billionaires. We're around 300 plus billionaires. There are a couple more, still 300 billionaires. That's a lot of billionaires. But those billionaires represent 1/10,000th of 1%, not 1%. We've got to stop this nonsense, this intellectual dishonesty and conceit of saying 1%. It's not even an appropriate metaphor, because standing behind those are 10 million millionaires. Now, 10 million are just the people whose money, who created that money. But each one of those people represents a total of 4 people, a husband, wife, and 2 children. So now that gives you 44 million. Now, these are people who can buy pretty much whatever they want, what within means, but they don't have to buy a Ford or a Chevy or Dodge or Buick or a truck or Mazda or Honda. They can buy a Ferrari, a Lamborghini. I don't think they would buy Bugatti, because those can go from $1.5 to $3 million. But they can live very nicely. They can have a yacht, 70-foot, 100-foot yacht, not a David Geffen 500-foot yacht. So you got 44 million people in a country of 331 million. But right behind them, you have 17.2 professional class, okay? And now when you add up the 17.2 professional class and their husband, wives, and children, you're dealing with 68 million. So the reality is, so let's finally once and for all get this straight and stop this nonsense and these stupid economists of giving us false figures. We have 100, and we'll round it off. It should be 112. We'll say 110 million Americans who are living very nicely, thank you. They can go to any private school. If they're the millionaire, their parents can see that they have a floating expense account, a black American Express card with no limit on it. They'll buy them an apartment and have it professionally decorated. Their kids can fly on private jets. The professional class can't do that. Now, they can go and will go to Harvard and Yale and Stanford and University of Chicago and Columbia and Brown, the other Ivy League schools. But they're creating debt to do it. And because they are lawyers and doctors and engineers, accountants and professors, and money managers and entrepreneurs, they can struggle and do it as long as their income isn't changed too much. But because I have people I know, in fact, people who live in my building in New York, who are money managers, financial experts, they tell me that every one of their clients, and I said, you mean everyone? And one man, who I've known for 20 years, said, every single client I have is spending whatever they make. So if they make $5 million a year, they'll spend $5 million. But they're not spending it on things that will give them value. Almost everything they spend their money on is to impress other people, them or their kids, and their kids as bad as they are. So he says, so now some of their income streams are no longer able to be maintained, so they're saying, what can I do? And I said, you got to sell stuff. And he says, so one guy spent $3.5 million on a yacht, and now the yacht's worth about $600,000. Another guy spent money on a Rolex, diamond-studded. It was worth about $100,000, or it was valued at $100,000. I can get maybe $12,000 for it. They can't believe how stupid they were in their investments. But people who get into buying things based upon ego or need or social status, they never stop and think, do I need it? Am I overpaying for it? And if you think they're not very smart, then their kids are absolutely dumb, and they have no responsibility. So we're dealing, let's be realistic, we're dealing with 100 million out of 330, well, it's 31, but 330 million. So you're dealing with 30%. 30%. So if you said 1% versus 99, it's different than saying 30% versus 70%. So now you're going to hear from one of those 30%. And it is so common because I've been there, I've counseled their kids, I've had them in my office, and this is how they think. This is not an aberration. This is the real McCoy. So that's what we're going to be dealing with today. A lot of interesting things. And of course, my guest, who I'll be bringing on a little later, because he's going to tie his comments into what these people are saying and how we end up where we're at. And he is Jeremy Lent from San Francisco. And he's a researcher, author, and founding president of the Liology Institute, a nonprofit organization dedicated to fostering a worldview that promotes future sustainability. We always start with the latest on health and healing, and I might mention, for those who have just joined us, who are hearing us for the first time, all of the information that I share on this program comes from peer-reviewed literature. For example, think of nutmeg. Not most people know about nutmeg seasonally, one time a year. Around Thanksgiving, we have pumpkin pies or eggnog. Well, nutmeg should be used on a regular basis. When you smell nutmeg, it evokes images of the fall, of hot apple cider. But the spice has been used for a long time in traditional Chinese medicine to treat gastrointestinal illnesses. Now one group reports in the peer-reviewed journal ACS's Journal of Proteome Research that they have figured out how nutmeg helps other organs, specifically your liver. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the world consumes 9,000 tons of nutmeg annually. Nutmeg is the seed of a particular fragrans tree, which is commonly found in Indonesia and has been used to treat asthma and rheumatic pain, toothaches, and infections. And in the laboratory, researchers have shown that nutmeg can fight hyperlipidemia and hypoglycemia and hyperglycemia and heart tissue damage and hepatotoxicity. So the researchers went ahead to see what else will it do, and sure enough, it is a terrific model if you have toxic liver conditions. And it goes into, the science on this is rather complicated, but it goes into the gene expression studies showed that a particular proliferation activated receptor, which is called alpha, PPARA, was modulated by nutmeg. And the spice didn't protect mice from liver injury if the gene was deleted. So in addition, the team found that a specific compound in nutmeg, a specific chemical, had a strong protective effect against liver damage. So in takeaway messages, if you have been a drinker, if you've had sclerosis of the liver or hepatitis or any other condition like non-fatty liver disease where your liver is damaged, then sprinkling some nutmeg each day into your smoothie can make a big difference and help you. And for those of you doing detoxes, liver flushes with wheatgrass juice and spirulina juice, throw nutmeg in there as well. We should all be concerned about stroke. It's the silent killer. Most people are not even aware that they have elevated blood pressure. But according to Sichuan University in China, and research updated in the American Journal of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, which is the journal of the Association of Academic Physicians, the magnetic stimulation to the brain can increase walking speed in patients who are undergoing rehabilitation for a stroke. Now, all of us, I'm sure, have known someone who has had a stroke, and you know the debilitation. Generally, one side is paralyzed. Sometimes part of their face is paralyzed, as if they have Bell's palsy. They have weakness and atrophy of the arm. And so there are different techniques that can help this. But this non-invasive, repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, or what is called TMS, especially high-frequency stimulation on the same side of the brain where the stroke occurred, leads to improved walking speed. And according to the review and the meta-analysis from the MDs working on this, and this was also at Harvard Medical School reviewed and Massachusetts General Hospital, so it can make a big difference in improving balance and the outcomes of a person with stroke. Now, combine that with nutrients that we know, like glycerol phosphocholine, phosphatidylserine, acetyl-L-carnitine, and ginkgo biloba, ginseng, and use hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and you can really recover a lot stronger. And I was working at the Tri-State Medical Center with all of our physicians and researchers, and we began to do research with magnetic stimulation of the brain, and we saw improvements. In fact, we saw improvements with all kinds of neurological conditions, including ALS and multiple sclerosis. Not cures, but improvements. So that's what this is showing, that what it is a 10 TMS, you're giving pulses of electricity into the brain, not harsh, not to damage, but to stimulate. And there are at least 5 randomized controlled trials, including patients with ischemic stroke, which is caused by a blood clot, or hemorrhagic stroke, which is caused by bleeding within the brain. And 7 studies used high-frequency TMS, and 2 used low-frequency, and the studies were rated as high quality, but varied in terms of time since stroke. And the high quality and the high frequency got the best results. So something to think about. Why? Because 700,000 people in the United States will have a stroke this year. And about 30% of those who have a stroke cannot walk independently for 6 months to a year after their stroke. So walking is crucial, and this helps a person get back up and walk. Some Stanford University scientist used dietary seaweed to manipulate in a positive way the gut bacteria in mice. Now, we all know that gut bacteria thrive on the food we eat. In turn, they provide essential nutrients to keep us healthy and repel pathogens and even help guide our immune response. So understanding how and why some beneficial bacteria strains can be even more successful and how they take up residence in the large intestine while others are quickly evicted could help scientists learn how to manipulate the makeup of thousands of bacteria species in ways that enhance our health. But it's very complex because the gut ecology is extremely complex. But new research at Stanford University School of Medicine, working with laboratory mice, have shown that it's possible to favor the engraftment of one bacterial strain over others by manipulating the diet. And they did this with a browned seaweed. And that caused an enormous benefit to the gut bacteria in the body. And this was published in the most respected scientific journal in the world, Nature, current issue out right today. So that's the latest in the world of science. And finally, from the Medical University of Vienna, which is in Austria. If you've never been to Austria, this summer, take a trip. Some of the most beautiful structures, architecture, parks in all of Europe. The people were very nice, at least my experience in Austria was that. The Medical University of Vienna did some research. And they did research about the healing power of red wine. And they found that red wine lowers the risk of prostate cancer. Now, you're talking about one glass a day, no more, and it cuts the chances of getting the disease by 12%. Now, that's in 17 separate studies. In contrast, white wine increases the risk by 26%. So just keep that in mind, but here's the takeaway message. You don't have to have any red wine at all. You can get a non-alcoholic wine. That's fine. You can get a wine without sulfates, which could harm your breathing. That's good, too. But what's in the red wine? Resveratrol. There are over 5,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing the power of resveratrol. That's why I suggest people have it every day. That's why I suggest people have grapes or grape juice or grape concentrate or grape powder. I do every day. 3 scoops because I know what it does. Now, the resveratrol and also the grape seed and the grape skin are the power. So if you ate grapes, that would be one way of getting it, in a delicious way, an enjoyable way. You don't get it in white grapes. You get it in blue, black, and red grapes. You can also get it in grape juice, which you get actually more resveratrol if you have a glass of grape juice, like a glass of Concord grape juice. If you have grape concentrate, you get even more still, because to get the grape concentrate, they have to wick out or evaporate approximately 1/3 of the water so it concentrates the juice. That's also better than anything, and best of all is taking the grape powders, because then you're getting far more of the resveratrol and the healing power of grape skin and grape seed extract. Now, how much more? An average bottle of red wine probably has around 5 to 10 milligrams of resveratrol. Eating grapes is going to give you double that. Drinking a glass of grape juice will give you about 100 milligrams. And then concentrate is going to give you around 150. So the more concentrated it is, the better it is for you. So you can do any of that you want. At least now you know why it's all beneficial. It's all good. We're 20 minutes into our program. I'm still filming. Be back shortly to New York. I'm preparing for brand new feature presentation. I haven't mentioned it. It'll be a surprise. And my other film is still being watched. I haven't even distributed it yet. I'm kind of backed up. I'm doing more films than what I have time for. And I just was notified today by my office, by our senior producer, Valerie, and we just got this notice. What is the Indie Festival Film Awards? On behalf of our entire staff and panel of judges, I'm pleased to inform you that you have won an Indie Fest Film Award. This is very prestigious, by the way. Gary Noll, USA, film Deadly Deception, Exposing the Dangers of Vaccine, 3 awards. First, Award of Merit Special Mention Documentary Feature. Second, Award of Excellence, Liberation, Social Issues, and Protest. Third, Award of Excellence, Public Service Programming. So, thank you. I have some film festivals coming up. Unfortunately, I'm probably going to be a finalist in maybe 50. I can't get to them. But if people in this audience around the United States, around the world, Spain, London, Germany, Venice, Hawaii, Alaska, California, we're all over the place. If because this is a big film. If any of you would like to go in my place, sit in. Everything's free, and you get to see and meet all these other wonderful filmmakers. I have enormous respect for them. We have great times afterwards. All the directors get together and we go have dinner and talk about, you know, the films. And I always like to find out what gave them their motivation, their ideas. Anyhow, you can do that for an evening. And if I should be fortunate enough to win, you can go up and give an acceptance speech. People have done that, done very well. Anyhow, we're going to come back in a moment. Please stay with us.
My baby loves me. Oh, yeah. My baby needs me. Oh, yeah. No other guy can whisper sweet things in my ear. My sweet.
Now we're going to listen to a millennial. This is a millennial who is trying to motivate other millennials to get real and to start looking at their level of conditioning and how they've gotten to where they have been so mocked and ridiculed more than any generation in American history. Every generation has its uniqueness and its limitations and strengths, but millennials are completely different. But I also want to be the first to stand up and defend those millennials who've had the blessed adventure of having parents that cared about them, didn't try to become their best friend, didn't spoil them, gave them a sense of character development and honesty and morals and ethics and manners, and because some of those work with me. And I can tell you, I've never met harder workers than those, and yet I've met a lot of the other millennials who are very much like what you're going to hear about now. And this is going to lead into our guest, so this is our first one, the most dumbed down and brainwashed generation in history. That's not me saying it. This is this millennial. Here you are.
Why? Well, there's a high level of obesity. This is embarrassing. Obesity. Unfit physically, unable to perform the most basic military maneuvers. Uneducated. Oh, wait a minute. Are you going to say we're uneducated? You can go to school and be uneducated. Isn't that an incredible realization? That you can go through school and they can pass you because they don't want you just lingering in the grade. And they'll keep moving you through the system and they'll stick out practically illiterate students all the time. They can find oatmeal in the grocery store because they recognize the oatmeal box, not because they can read oatmeal. Unlearned mentally, unable to pass the most basic academic tests of competence. We can't hear. You have to be able to hear, I guess, to get into the military at some level. lost acute hearing ability due to the volume of music. It's embarrassing. We are unfit to protect our lives, to protect our marriages, to protect our families, to protect our towns, protect our states, to protect our nations. We are unready for battle. So The Dumbest Generation Ever, this is the book that I was referring to. It's actually called The Dumbest Generation, or this is the other option title for it, or Don't Trust Anyone Over 30. That's an attitude of an entire generation. You can't trust these guys. Those over 30, we have definitely seen some weaknesses in the older generation. There's no doubt about it. But I want you to know, those over 30 possibly know more than you do, as those of you that are under 30. You may know more about computer programming. However, they oftentimes know more about life. And we have disconnected ourselves from any knowledge fuel source that would give us an understanding of how life actually works. So look at this. It goes through, I think it's like six things I'll mention here, but six observations of why we are the dumbest generation ever. How do you guys like being classified as that? Isn't that a fun title to wear? See, I'm trying to get you mad, is what I'm trying to do. Don't accept that title. Don't sit around and allow that to be your title. Hit it back. Knowledge deficits. The least supply of common life, social, and cultural knowledge of any generation. This is my little statement that I add to it. Disconnect them from their devices and they die. See, as long as they have their computer, their laptop, their PDA, whatever it is, they can make it through life. They can figure out directions. They can do their research. How do they do their research? Google. That's their research. And so as a result, you disconnect them from their devices, stick them in a forest all by themselves and, run away with the car. They die. They have no way of surviving. They do not know how to live outside of the system. They're bibliophobes, which isn't just a fear of the Bible. This is a fear of books. The highest disregard of books and reading of any generation. Now, look, here's my comment. Give them a book and they turn it into kindling. Number three, screen time. It's the greatest amount of time in front of a screen of any generation. I mean, you could say, well, previous generations didn't even have screens. I don't know what it was, the 40s or 50s when television started coming out, and they were watching television all the time because it was such a novelty. It doesn't even compare to what we are doing in this generation. We are almost always in front of a screen, whether it's a computer screen or a television screen or a movie screen. Almost always, or a cell phone screen. Whatever it is, we are addicted to the screen. And obviously, this is having some kind of effect upon us. Don't expect them to be involved in the rescue of this world, for they are completely lost in another one. Online learning skills, the least effective research skills which garner true information of any generation. Our generation does not know how to find true information. We know how to find information. We have the information superhighway. Oh yeah, we know how to find information. Is it true? Are you able to test and see if it's true? Do you have any filter of knowing if it's true? Well, it's the highest Google ranking. Let me tell you, the highest Google ranking is nearly inevitably wrong. Okay? It does not necessarily mean it is right. It just means more people are turning to it than something else. There are all sorts of top Google rankings in this world, but that does not mean that they are true. The motto for information gathering, the highest Google ranking rules. Wikipedia is the new Bible. And good bloggers are the oracles of the now. If you can write, this generation will submit to you, lay down their lives before you and say, train my mind how to think. It does not mean that you know how to live. It does not mean you have a scrap of actual real world intelligence. You have not earned a medal through your life lived. And yet you can write and you can impress people with your phraseology. And as a result, this generation will submit to you and they will follow your lead. You could be 17 years old and not know a thing, but you can write. You can control the minds of a generation. Betrayal of mentors is another hallmark of this generation, of these 18 to 24 year olds. They're the most apt to disbelieve, disregard, or betray teachers and mentors of any generation. Their commitments mean nothing, for they are loyal only to that which feels good to them in the moment.
Okay. My guest is on hold, and I've asked him to listen in before we go to him because I want him to hear some of the issues of why. Because let's put this into proper context. Right now, there's a growing number of young, more idealistic millennials who were behind Bernie Sanders, but should have saw that Bernie was not the right person when Bernie, having legitimately been the choice, when it was determined while he was still in play that he had been betrayed by the Democratic machine and Hillary Clinton and Donna Brazile and Wasserman Schultz and the others, he should have protested. He didn't. He should have dropped out as for a congressional hearing. He didn't. He should have taken that massive young idealistic group and forced a new socialist Democratic Party. He didn't. And that's unfortunate because on some issues, he certainly was on the right side of truth. But on all others, support of Israel, demeanment of the Palestinians, he is on the wrong side of history. But now, where do you think in this upcoming next election cycle, all those young people are going to go? They're going to follow him. And he might be the Democratic nomination, maybe not. But when he becomes a Democratic nomination, he is also going to have to support a lot of the Democratic principles, which are the neoliberal principles, which are the fascistic principles, totalitarian principles, the police state principles. Will he stop asset forfeiture? No. Will he go back and insist that a new attorney general go back with the Justice Department and bring all of the former presidents of the United States and all their cabinet members who can be shown and proven in a court of law to have violated international treaties and especially engaged in human rights violations, which there is no statute of limitations, and bring them to justice? He will never do that. You will never see in the United States a previous high-ranking politician brought to justice, nor anyone in the CIA, nor these 17 intelligence agencies. But these millennials do not have that comprehension because they don't have the world experience. And every time asked, would you, like with one of the most disingenuously dumb group I've ever met, were the people who were Occupy Wall Street, when I said there's a whole group of African-American and Latinos, Native Americans, and older hippies, and all of us who were against the Vietnam War, work with us. We have insight, knowledge, we can help you. No, we don't want, this is ours. Since when did human rights, civil rights, earth rights, animal rights, since when did it become generationally specific? This is the kind of selfishness, this conceit that somehow because they have an attitude, they have knowledge to go with it. You don't have knowledge. You have an attitude. But it doesn't mean that you're on the right side of this. And Chris Hedges gave us a lot to think about. And he is one of the most formidable minds on the planet. So think of this for a moment. Because who almost always comes up to fill the vacuum in any movement? Those who should never have been given the power. Anyone who needs power over you should be the last person you give it to, whether it's in a relationship or in any other environment. Because almost always these people are going to be corrupted by their need for power, their underlying hidden insecurities. I mean, look, we just saw it in the Attorney General of New York resigning. Not because he didn't have consensual sex, is because he didn't have consensual violence, a new term, where the women were not into his rough sex. Of course, that also should be looked at more carefully than why did you keep going back over and over and over again and engaging in something that you would later then say that you were opposed to. If you were opposed to the first time he hit you and smacked you, you should have had him arrested, even if he is the attorney general. But this is the kind of the sociopathology of interpersonal dysfunction that we're immersed in today. And according to Chris Hedges, and let's think on this for a moment, just for a moment, before we go to our guest. We keep looking for the leaders to lead us. I'm opposed to that. Because no leader is bigger than any movement. No leader, no matter how talented or visionary, like Ralph Nader, effectively defines power without a disciplined organizational foundation. The civil rights movement was no more embodied in Dr. Martin Luther King than the socialist movement was embodied in Eugene V. Debs And as the civil rights leader Ella Baker understood, the civil rights movement made King, and King did not make the civil rights movement. We must focus on building new radical movements that do not depend on foundation grants and media platforms or the Democratic Party that is so corrupt, or revolve around the cult of leadership, like Bill Clinton and Al Gore represented the new cult of the new Democrat, and Hillary Clinton represented the cult of the new she's a woman, it's her time, and Barack Obama represented the cult of he's black, it's our time. How'd that work out? We got them. Every one of them was a fraud. Every one of them debased every single principle of moral and ethical behavior when it came to honoring anything except themselves and the people really behind them. All of our radical and populist organizations, including unions and the press, the honest press, they're decimated or they're destroyed. The only media that we should trust is the alternative media, and then make sure that you're able to support and prove what it's giving you is honest. Countercurrents, Truth Dig, Global Research, PRN, Progressive Radio Network, these are the future. And why? Because every one of these was founded by, like a Dean Baker or others, founded by people who had been a part of mainstream media and saw that it was being co-opted, compromised, and they broke loose and created something that was independent. We must understand that it is not about us. It's about our neighbor. It's about the other. We must not be crippled by despair. Our job is to wake up and confront evil. In my personal opinion, and I'm only stating my personal opinion, the most evil force on the planet today is not the oligarch. It is not the duopoly. It is not the corruption of the technocrats working in all of our agencies. It's how our government does not exist at all on any level representing the interest in the future of the planet, the people, and peace. And yet if we're codependent upon it, we don't realize what it could be in its ideal form. We simply compromise to it, in which case when we compromise to it, we compromise down to its level. All great, great crusades for justice outlast us. We are measured not by that we achieve, but by how passionately and honestly we fight. Only then do we have any chance to thwart corporate power and protect a rapidly degrading ecosystem. Now, maybe that's not understood, so let me just explain what it means. It means receding into the landscape to build community organizations and relationships that for months, maybe years, will be unseen by mass culture. It means beginning where people are. It means listening. It means establishing credentials as a member of a community willing to make personal sacrifices for the well-being of others. It means being unassuming, humble, and often unnamed and unrecognized. It means, as Cornel West said, not becoming ontologically addicted to the camera. It means that rejecting the obsession with self as some kind of grand messianic gift to the world. And one of the most important aspects of organizing is grassroots educational programs that teach people by engaging them in a dialogue about the structures of corporate power and the nature of oppression. Simply said, you cannot fight what you do not understand. Effective political change is not primarily politically motivated. It is grounded in the human solidarity and mutual trust and consciousness. Wasn't it Harriet Tubman who said, I rescued many slaves, but I could have saved 1,000 more if the slaves knew they were slaves? That said, I have just completed 3 independent original investigations with our scholar in resident, Richard Gale. They are posted. The articles are posted, fully footnotes and referenced. They've been completely vetted. Our radio shows on these are up and posted in the archives. I want to thank the 10,000 people who just downloaded our archive on homeopathy. And all of this to show you that just one source, Wikipedia, and one group within, embedded in Wikipedia, the skeptics, are at the heart of so much that is vile and wrong. And that they have the power. They're anonymous. You don't know who they are. All you do is go to Wikipedia and read something and think, well, that's the truth. How do you know it's the truth? As this man just said, prove it. So we're trying to provide you with the tools if you use them. And if you read an article, if you agree with it, pass it on, share it. What they can't control at this moment is how many times you can share an article or a broadcast or a documentary, including Deadly Deception, the one that just won this international award. Share these tools because this is how you build a grassroots movement to take the power away from them, because now you know that you can't trust them. These are not good people. And once you realize you're not a good person, you're a selfish person, you've lied to me, I'm not going to give you my power. I'm not going to vote for you. I'm not going to listen to your radio show. I'm not going to watch your own television. I'm not going to read your articles in the newspaper. I'm not going to listen to you because you're not ethical. You're not moral. You're not honorable. You have no character. That is where we have to go. And now let's go over and by the way, one quick one. Here's another millennial. This is only about 35, 40 seconds. She's in a car. And she just starts to, and there were 41 million millennials who downloaded this. And she just says this about what she and her generation represent. This will lead into my guest.
The millennial, I took it upon myself to try to evaluate what's so wrong with our generation and why they're so mad at us. And then I pretty much realized that we're just existing. We're not really contributing anything to society. Our generation doesn't have the basic manners that include no ma'am and yes ma'am. We don't respect our elders. We don't even respect our country. We're stepping on our flag instead of stepping up to volunteer. And we idolize people like Kim Kardashian, and then we shame people like Tim Tebow. We're lazy. We're really entitled. And we want to make a lot of money and have free education, but we're not really willing to put in the work. We're more divided as a country than ever before. And I think our generation actually has a lot to do with that. Everything that used to be frowned upon is now celebrated.
Okay, now let's say hello to Jeremy Lent in San Francisco. Hi, Jeremy. Nice to have you with us today.
Hey, Gary. Yeah, happy to be on the show with you. Thank you.
And I gave your background a little earlier at the introduction of the show. You're a graduate, of course, of Cambridge University. I also have an MBA from University of Chicago, and also a former CEO and chairman of a public internet company. You're the author of Pattering Instinct, The Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning, which explores the way humans have found and created meaning from ancient times to the present. And I really like your article in Tycoon and Resilience Journals, Salon, and Huffington Post. On the intellectual challenges historians and philosophers and sociologists confront is to understand past forces and trends that create the dominant worldviews that we now live with and face in the present. And certainly one of the more dominant worldviews is the paradigm of endless progress and consumption. And the critics of the 19th century worldviews looked at a trajectory of capitalism that has brought us to this impasse. And they keep on warning that this is simply unsustainable. We just can't keep growing and consuming everything because we want it. It increasingly divides the global community between the have and have-nots, whereby the former are fueled with purpose and meaning in their lives, albeit, in my opinion, very destructive, and the latter increasingly lose their sense of meaning and bask in sadness and despair. And yet, as you have noted in your recent large tome, there are many layers of cognitive understanding of humanity's relationship with the planet and life and the world and even our human faculties. And the push for progress that has given shape to the dominant worldview of meaning that defines postmodern civilization. So perhaps take us on this journey, looking from the end of the 17th century and then the Age of Reason, mostly through the 19th. What are the most salient thought forms and patterns and behaviors that have been inherited to create the current worldview that now threatens our very existence as a species? The form is yours.
Sure. Thank you, Gary. And I think you're right to look at that time in the sort of 17th century as really the time when our modern worldview was founded. And people are not so much aware of that, just in our sort of day-to-day existence. But a lot of the underlying sort of structures of meaning we take for granted in today's world actually came from people really who developed what was called what's called the scientific revolution, basically around the 17th century is when it really got started. And they formed the sort of the foundations for how we think about things today. So, for example, they had these ideas that at the time they thought were revolutionary, like we should look at nature as a machine. Or there was this guy called Francis Bacon, who was one of the sort of triumphalists of the scientific revolution at the time, who said, we've got to conquer nature. You know, this is, of course, in those days, he'd say man rather than humankind because they just saw everything from the patriarchal lens. But, you know, this is man's, vision is to conquer nature and to even sort of use these kind of notions of putting her on the rack and torturing her until we get the truth out of it. And what's amazing is that these ideas, at the time, they were kind of exciting, and they've become embedded into every way we think about things right now. So we think of nature as this kind of material resource for consumption. And we think of technology as being this ability for us to do whatever we want, to kind of manipulate nature with how we want it to be. And we even have this notion of our own sort of bodies being this kind of split between hardware and software, like mind and body. So you have these technological sort of singularitarians here in Silicon Valley talking about how one day we'll become immortal because we can just download, upload our minds to the cloud and then download it to a new body. So all these different ways of thinking began at that time. And it's no surprise, really, that the modern corporation got actually invented at that same time period to enable people to take this kind of sense of conquering and apply it to other nations and other worlds. You know, the corporation initially got created to offer limited liabilities for people to set out expeditions to the to Southeast Asia to kind of bring back all the goods that were the very sort of seeds of colonialism and imperialism that we saw unfold over the centuries after that. And that same limited liability corporation, I think, is one of the major reasons why we're on this uncontrolled trajectory right now, potentially leading to the collapse of our civilization if we continue to consume the Earth at its current rate.
Thank you. I appreciate that overview. In the past, I brought on systems theorist Erwin Laszlo, both Fritjof Capra and Paul Ehrlich, George Borgstrom. Are you familiar with George Borgstrom?
Rene
Dubot. Buckminster Fuller. These were the older ones. I had them on back in the 1970s. And then, of course, some of the people I'm sure you're aware of, Stuart Kaufman, Ralph Abraham, Rupert Sheldrake, and others. And they all say that to understand why it is that we are destroying the Earth's biodiversity and forests and oceans, and now being the main contributor to global warming, we must learn to think in terms of systems, not simply linear progressions, which I believe is rather utopian and wrong-headed. But our minds are conditioned to think linearly and not in systems that can embrace wholeness. The idea that the whole is much greater than the sum of the numerous parts. And simply understanding systems intellectually is not the same as living it and acting upon it and thinking daily in a systemic way that that is meaningful. One of the ways you suggest is that we need to learn to and find solutions that are both top-down and bottom-up. Would you explain that in practical terms?
Yes, yeah, and thank you for bringing that up. And yeah, and in fact, something that I look at in the book is exactly what you're describing, is the rise of systems thinking in Western thought over the last few hundred years, and how that offers an alternative paradigm to that modern Western worldview that I was just describing. And what's also exciting about it is that it links in with a lot of the traditional wisdom we see from non-Western cultures, in particular traditional Chinese thought. And that's actually a theme I go into in some detail in my book, is that linkage. And so to answer your question about top-down and bottom-up, I do think that is one of the most important insights from understanding how systems work. And so, like, a simple way of recognizing what that means is that any complex system, whether it's something as tiny as a single cell or as large as a massive ecosystem, it works where all the different parts of the system interact with each other to have an effect on the whole of the system. But the system as a whole is also interacting on all of the different parts. And that's what, and sometimes that's known as reciprocal causality, because the parts are sort of causing the whole to be what they are, and vice versa. And top down and bottom up is another way of looking at it. So, like, a great example to see exactly what that means in real life is to look at something like a tropical forest. So you have we sort of think of a forest as being a whole bunch of trees, basically. But when the trees are together like that, the foliage and the dense foliage actually creates its own climate. So all of the evaporation from the trees create the clouds, which then enhance the amount of rainfall that comes out. And then if you look underneath the trees, all of the roots form together to form this kind of neural network, if you will. And you have all of the undergrowth that can exist because of the shade from the trees. So the system as a whole is allowing all the different parts to be what they are, and the parts are making that system. And that's where, when you have something like deforestation, and it's not like you can sort of just thin out a forest and expect it to be like it was before, only a little bit thinner. What happens is, at a certain point, it stops being that forest, that sort of the whole and affecting the part. And then, you know, you go through a moment where you can't come back from, and then it turns into scrubland. So, and we see this in human society too. So in fact, I was just hearing you talk about this notion of leadership and how we need to look at the grassroots rather than sort of be led by some sort of big name person. And so that notion of leadership that we often follow in West, well, basically in many human societies, is a sense of like the top down without the bottom up. And I do think that, you know, all of us individually, as you were just saying before, by working within our connected environments, by sort of thinking of ourselves as nodes within this much larger system, we're able to affect things in a much more profound way than by just looking to some leader to tell us what to think.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Right now, we have been working on a series of long investigations into the threats being posed by the growing movement known as skepticism, which is fundamentally a very deterministic and reductionist view of what humans are capable of knowing and not knowing. And it is science-based, and as I've said to listeners, it is based upon a science of cold facts and deconstructions of anything that cannot be measured, such as alternative health, spirituality, healing through energy, that is fundamentally amoral and divorces ethics altogether. That's their view. It is almost an inversion of a holistic view that you just mentioned just now. And another name for it might be scientism, as a faith-based movement that relies solely on the rational faculties and determinist, and denies anything associated with intention, higher emotions, moral equivalencies that also provide us with meaning. So based upon what you said earlier, how would you critique skepticism as a product of the forces that are now threatening the planet?
Yes, and the word that I like to use for that way of thinking that you just described is reductionism. And the reason why is that really, I don't think we should sort of cede this notion of science and scientism to these other guys, because, in fact, their approach is truly unscientific. And because what the reductionists have done essentially is they've looked at the power and, you know, and well, first off, maybe I should just define what I mean by reductionism. It's this approach to science that says that you can understand the truths about the universe by dividing it into the smallest possible unit. And by understanding that smallest possible unit, you can sort of build that up and understand how things work. And the reality is that over the last few hundred years, reductionism has been very successful in understanding a lot of things in physics and biology and the world in general. And it's allowed all, so much of the technology we see today. But what the reductionists have done is they've taken the success of their model within particular parameters, and they've applied it to essentially an ontological understanding. They said because it works so well to reduce things to its tiniest parts, we've got to say the whole universe is nothing but all of these parts, which leads them to say, well, if that's the case, and the universe just consists of all this stuff sort of randomly hitting each other, then obviously the universe is meaningless. And then when people come along and say, we actually have to look at how things connect up as part of understanding what reality really is, they say, oh, no, that's irrelevant. Because actually, you know, we've just told you the universe is nothing but those discrete parts. But to say that is a little bit like saying, well, you know, Shakespeare's works are really nothing but, you know, 26 letters that just kind of repeat themselves in these different intervals across across all these books. So it's this, it's kind of this meaningless, it sort of loses meaning by just looking at those parts. And I think that what systems thinking allows us to do to what you're describing, by looking at how those parts connect up, I don't believe that systems thinking should be used instead of that, those reductionist insights. But a true understanding of the universe needs to include both. And it needs to recognize that by understanding how things connect, to your very point, it creates the whole is something very different from all of the parts. And what's so exciting about that is that when we do start looking at connection, we do see meaning in the universe. Rather than that kind of reductionist meaninglessness, we see that meaning itself, in fact, I like to define meaning itself as a function of connectedness. The more things are connected, the more they mean. And ultimately, when people talk about that sense of total universal connectivity, and sometimes even talk about it in terms of a sense of unconditional love, that is really a realization of the connectedness of all things.
Much appreciate that on a closing note. Jeremy, thank you very much for sharing your insights. I look forward to a longer conversation on an upcoming program.
That's great. Thanks very much, Gary. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Jerry Lent, author of The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.